Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. This month marks the start of school in districts around Charlotte, and this school year will begin with some new rules thanks to recent laws passed by the legislature and signed by the governor. Those changes include parameters for cell phone use during educational periods, requirements for teaching media literacy, even a new law that allows automated speed cameras in school zones. But each district has its own policies and concerns, too. Recently, we spoke with CMS Superintendent Dr. Crystal Hill about what CMS is working toward as they prepare to go back to school on August 25th. Today we hear from the superintendents of three systems surrounding Charlotte. Union County is the sixth largest district in the state. They join CMS with August 25th as their back-to-school date. Their superintendent is Dr. Andrew Houlihan, and he joins us along with the leaders of the Cabarrus and Iredell-Statesville schools. They started school on Monday. Dr. John Kopicki is superintendent of Cabarrus County Schools. Dr. Jeffrey James is superintendent of Iredell-Statesville Schools. Good morning, gentlemen. Welcome to all three of you. Thank you for being here.
Morning.
This is going to be kind of a redundant show because in terms of the questions, because I'm going to ask all three of you a lot of these questions because they all pertain to how you're dealing with certain things. And let's begin with the $6.8 billion in cuts in funding from the federal government that have now been restored thanks to a lawsuit brought by several states' attorneys general, including our Jeff Jackson. Our state was set to lose $165 million, I think that's right, at stake $12.2 million. $1 million for CMS, $1.63 million for Cabarrus County, $1.08 million for Iredell-Statesville, and $1.84 million for Union County Schools. Once again, that money has been restored, but the lawsuit alleged that the cuts were unlawful and unconstitutional because they had been approved by the Congress. Had you lost that funding, what would it have meant to your school systems? And Dr. Houlihan, I will begin with you in Union County.
Yeah, so for us, I mean, it would have been a considerable hit, mostly in terms of funding that supports our migrant programs, our English as a second language programs. We've seen a huge demographic shift in our county in the last 4 to 5 years, not necessarily with an increase in our Hispanic population only, but also our Ukrainian and Russian population along I-74. We had committed funds to programming, to translators, to family engagement specialists, trying to get these new families engaged in what's happening in schools, trying to break down barriers of communication. So a lot of our funds would have been tied to that. We're very glad that the federal government restored those funds. But to be honest with you, we're kind of treating this as a one-year grant. And trying to figure out what to do a year from now to bring those funds back, even on a local or statewide basis.
Dr. Kopicki, same question to you. What would it have meant to Cabarrus County Schools?
Yeah, I think in echoing what Dr. Houlihan said, much of that money, I think, across districts is tied to salaries and benefits. So it's people. It's those resources that you use in the classroom that provide those opportunities educationally for our students. We are a growing district, and our population is becoming more and more diverse. Our English as a second language population is growing strongly. So it definitely would have been a hit to us, and we're coming off of probably the largest increase that our county ever gave us in the history of Cabarrus County. We 12.69% increase in our budget from last year, which we were very grateful for. So we were coming into the budget year feeling really good. And then the federal government came out with the potential to cut this money from us, which would have been, as you noted, $1.63 million. It would have been a significant hit, and we would have had to really be very nimble and try to adapt to cover that loss. But it's significant money. Every dollar helps, and grateful that that's still in our budget. And it'll allow us to provide those resources to our students.
Dr. James, you've been doing a lot of nodding as both of these fellows have been talking. It's hard to go third, but what would it have been to Iredell-Statesville?
It's almost ditto to what the other two have said. We are also growing rapidly, about the second or third largest growing county in the state. We had nine positions covered with those funds, and I guess the worst part of it, we learned the night before the funds were being cut. So the next day they would have went into effect. So it gave us very little time to plan, come up with a backup to what we could do to continue to sustain those nine individuals. And like the other two counties, our largest growing population right now is Latino, and that continues to be number one in our county, and that would have greatly impacted our interpreters and the ability to work with non-English speaking parents and students. We have about 58 different languages spoken in Iredell County. So already working on a very thin margin of funding, that would have made a significant impact in our ability to continue employment for several people. And one thing that, as John's already said it, and Mr. Houlihan, or Dr. Houlihan, excuse me, has already said, about 92% of all of our budgets are salaries and benefits. So when we have a significant decrease in funding, it almost always ends up being people, not materials, not programs, people. So that was of grave concern. The board and I had quite a few conversations about how we could maybe push these individuals to different budgets until we could get a better idea of what was going to happen moving forward. But we are very appreciative it was unfrozen, absolutely.
One of you mentioned that you're viewing this as a one-term or a one-year grant because of some uncertainty about what may happen next year. And I know that the administration is making moves toward dissolving, at least their expressed desire is, to dissolve the Department of Education. I know you don't want to get political, but what worries you the most about this administration's approach to education, particularly public education? Where does your most of your concern lie about what the future may hold? And I'll start with you, Dr. Kopicki.
Yeah, I think it just follows up on the initial question. This is support that school districts, public educators, and public systems have counted on for, going on a half of a century now. So we've counted on these title funds for many, many years. And as my colleagues have known, that we use those resources many different ways. But bottom line is, we fund a lot of our positions with those resources to help our kids. So any loss, it's razor thin. The budgets are razor thin in terms of how we can support our students. So we count on those public funds and have counted on them for years. So Dr. Hulin makes a very good point that it could be a one-year grant because you never know. There's a lot of trepidation around which way the administration is going to go moving forward from a federal standpoint. Years ago, you were just counting on this. It was never an issue. You were never worried about it. Now it's, you're not so certain or sure. So for us, we're already planning now for our 26-27 budget, and we're kind of looking at two different windows. Okay, we've received these funds. Here's what we look at. If we don't receive them, which way are we going? So it's a precarious situation to be in, to be very frank with you. And you lose that kind of funding, it hits the system hard.
Dr. James?
Again, similar here with us. With funding, I think one of the things our public needs to understand, 150-year education system, through that, we've seen many changes. Of course, Sputnik generated quite a few changes with the nation at risk. But all through the history of public education, we have been the backbone that has continued to sustain this country as a world power. And what bothers me is we train about 98 to 99% of the blue-collar workforce. And when we lose money, in essence, it impacts our children, not just adults. If we lose positions, it also impacts what we can do to educate our children. So I think that's what we lose sight of sometimes when we cut funding. The old adage, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And I think we've seen some of that. All of us would say there's always ways to improve efficiencies and processes to save money. But at the end of the day, when we cut budgets, we're impacting the quality of education our kids receive.
Well, let's talk about that because the public school system, I think it's indisputable that the public school system has sustained an expanding United States for decades, for almost most of the 20th century and into the 21st century. And yet, There are those who believe that the public schools have failed us, and some of those people who believe that the public schools have failed us are taking steps for alternatives to become available. And I'm concerned, I'm wondering how concerned you are about how the recent expansion of the so-called opportunity scholarships, which give every student in the state money to attend the private school of their choice if they can get into the private school of their choice and pay the rest of the freight, because these opportunity scholarships don't pay the whole thing in many cases. Do you worry about a drain in both students and resources as a result of this, Dr. Houlihan?
I mean, do I worry? Yeah, sure, absolutely. But I look at this subject a little bit differently than some of my colleagues. And the fact that I just believe that we've got to wake up and realize we're in a competitive market. I mean, families have choice. To be honest with you, I agree with choice. I think parents should have the right to choose which kind of school their kids go to. What I don't agree with is public funding going to non-public schools. And I do believe that those funds should follow public school students. However, you know, Dr. Kopicki and Dr. James and I, we've all talked about the fact that we're in a different world, and getting our schools and our school systems equipped to handle and to market the great things happening in our school systems, and to try to figure out why would a family choose private or charter over a public school, that's on us. That's our responsibility. We've got to figure that out. We've got to figure out how to make all of our schools better in order to compete.
But really, is it on you? The private schools that will benefit from these opportunity scholarships will not have to, and do not have to, comply with the same standards or requirements that the public schools have to do. The same is true of charter schools, which are, yes, public schools, but they too operate on a different playing field. And those in favor of this say this provides, as you have mentioned, Dr. Houlihan, much needed choice. And others say these options put the public schools at a disadvantage and in fact could weaken them and make it kind of become fulfilling a prophecy that they failed us. It could help to hasten that failure, if that isn't even remotely true. Why do you believe this is happening, Dr. Kopicki?
I think the winds of change happened years ago. I mean, charter schools have been around for quite some time. So I agree with my colleagues on this as well. I'm not anti-private or public school. I feel as though my job is to promote the public school system that I'm working in, which is Cabarrus County, and tell everyone out there in this county why we are the best option, whether it be from an affordability standpoint, whether we're talking about a diverse learning environment, rigorous courses, qualified teachers, or how we connect to the community. I think that our job is to make sure that we're promoting and telling our story. I tell our folks all the time, tell your narrative. Don't let other people tell your story for you. And I think one of the things where public educators have lacked, have missed the mark, is that we have not been our best public relations folks over the years. We're competing. It's real. It's out there. And I don't mind the competition. The competition does not scare me, because I truly believe in my heart of hearts that Cabarrus County Schools offers the best education in this county. I tell folks we're one of the best systems in the nation. And I can prove that with data and evidence and how our students do across the local area when they compete, how they do across the state area when they compete, and then how they do nationally when they compete. Our kids go out there when they compete, they're very successful because they're very prepared by the excellent teachers that we have in the system. So I think this has been I don't want to even call it a problem. I just think it's been an issue that's been out there for a long period of time.
I think who controls the narrative wins, and I think I want to come back and talk more about that, because public schools have not tooted their own horn perhaps sufficiently enough. That was Dr. John Kopicki with Cabarrus County Schools. Dr. Jeff James was with us from Iredell Statesville Schools, and Dr. Andrew Houlihan is superintendent of Union County Schools. We're coming right back.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the British International School of Charlotte. Aiming to inspire high school students through an international curriculum and IB diploma program, preparing them for college, careers, and a global community. More at bischarlotte.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. With school already starting in some districts and about to start in others, we thought it would be a good idea to expand our conversation about schools beyond just CMS. And so today we have the superintendents of three area schools with us, Dr. Andrew Houlihan, superintendent of Union County Schools, Dr. John Kopicki, superintendent of Cabarrus County Schools, and Dr. Jeff James, superintendent of Iredell-Statesville Schools. There is an impression, as we've been talking about among some, that particularly on the right, the public schools have failed us. Those in public education, just as Dr. Kopicki just said, would say that that is simply not true. And anecdotally, a lot of parents with children in public schools love their teacher or love their schools and would take issue with that statement in particular, but maybe not in general. So somewhere the message has gotten garbled. Dr. James, why does this impression exist? Is it because public schools have not been effective in telling their story?
I would say that's part of it. And I think we constantly have to get our message out. And I would believe I'd probably answer for all three of us. And, you know, you still can go somewhere in any of the counties and someone really doesn't know all the data. We try to do data talks with some of our municipalities. And I've even had them say, wow, I didn't know the school was performing this well. I'm not sure if people just don't listen in or if it doesn't matter to them, they move on. And unfortunately, a lot of our people that went to our schools that have graduated and become grandparents, they're, and of course, rightly so, more concerned about what they're paying for taxes than they really are about the school system unless they have grandkids. But you mentioned something that's very near and dear to me that I have constantly talked about. The North Carolina Association of School Administrators recently put out the four entities in our state. So there's public school, there's charter school, there's private school, and there's homeschool. And if you look at the laws that govern each of those, they're very different. So two things that really, I think, hurt us, but again, we educate every child. But if you're a disruptive student at any of those other schools, they have the authority to remove you permanently. We do not. So what happens, Mike, is the disruptive students get sent back to public school, and we take them. We take every child. And students with disabilities, all of us statewide are seeing more significant disabilities walk into our kindergarten classrooms. And this is because of the opioid crisis and a lot of other things that have happened in our nation. And one of the statistics that one of our dear colleagues has put out for years, two of every five live births are impacted by either legal or illegal drug abuse. Those students demand significant services, and they are not fully funded. So when you go to a charter, they're unable to do it. They come back to us. So it almost seems like the public school's being penalized when it comes to the lawmaking authority. And I've asked my representatives, please help me understand when you're making rules, how you can segregate them out into four stacks. It should be an even playing field. And we have choice. We also reached out about 12 years ago to our homeschool parents, Mike, and started an iAcademy. So you can be a homeschool student, enroll. If you enroll in three classes with our district, you can participate in sports, band, anything else a public school student can do. That has grown substantially. I was at open house for that. Just for our high school, we had over 800 parents attend. So we're trying to, I guess, modernize what we think about public schools so we can offer additional choice. But all of my colleagues here today, we offer more choice than any other entity out there. We welcome competition. But this is my second career. We welcome fair competition. I was in textiles, so I'll say that again. Fair competition is welcome. And that's all we're asking for. But we are not dealt a level playing field.
That is a fact. A lot of people move here every day. Hundreds of people move here every day. And one of the couple of things that people look at when they decide precisely where they're going to locate, either buy a house or get an apartment for them and their families, and some of the, part of it's taxes, part of it, a big part of it, if you have kids, is where are the best schools? And I think Union County, for people moving to this region, has benefited from this to a great degree because they look at CMS, and CMS, although has a national reputation that's pretty solid, locally, if you talk to some people, they'll say, oh, no, the public schools are failing us. Go to Union County. And that's partly because perhaps CMS is not telling their story adequately. But the story that is told, that we report on here, is basically based on end-of-grade test scores. And there's no question that there are certain systems that are struggling with those test scores, with children having difficulty reading at grade level, doing math at grade level. Is that the case in Union County, Dr. Houlihan? Do you understand why that's the case elsewhere if it's not the case where you are, and why it is if it is the case where you are? Why?
I mean, I have a hard time with this question because you have to compare, or a lot of people want to compare the data and the research from pre-pandemic to post-pandemic, and really it's an apples to oranges comparison. I don't think you can do it. For us in Union County, we are the highest performing large district in the state. We have been for some time. We're proud of that fact, but that doesn't mean that we don't have issues. We have challenges across all of our schools. To be honest with you, our third grade literacy scores have got to get better. We've got to really figure out what strategies are working. We've had a major emphasis in this state more recently on the science of reading. We're seeing huge gains in our kindergarten through second grade classes, but in a lot of schools, that's not translating to third grade reading. That's going to really be our effort, I think, in the next few years to come. When it comes to mathematics performance, we're kind of known as a county that has gotten tremendous results compared to the state. The reason for that is we've implemented very innovative strategies for almost 10 years now that have really paid off, including, you know, daily in-school math tutoring for kids in all grade levels. And so, you know, for us, you know, I appreciate the compliment, Mike, that, you know, yes, people move to us because we're a high performing district, but we do struggle and have challenges just like any other school system. Our job is to try to figure out what's not working and make it better.
I believe I'm correct in saying that CMS is also moving to a different way of teaching reading, and this may have been the impetus by the previous superintendent of schools education at the state level, Catherine Truitt, who I think pushed this new way. Is this new way new, or is it just phonics?
Well, I think I'll jump in here with Mike. Science of reading is for the first time, I think, in many, many years, we've allowed educators to have a voice at the table when it comes to how to teach reading instead of politicians. So we have lived where the state legislator has picked reading programs that have been in place for many years and then failed. So there was a lot of research done with Mississippi. I actually talked to the researchers way before North Carolina adopted the science of reading, and very, very excited about it because I knew there was a better way to teach reading if we could just get the politics out of it. And we are seeing that, but you know, we actually visit Dr. Houlihan in his district because he has some great programs. The key here is high dose tutoring in math has really helped him, and I think you would say a great program. We brought it back here to Iredell. We've seen some of the highest math scores, and then the funding runs out. And you've got to have a sustainable amount of funding, and that's what hurts counties that have a low tax rate or get limited funding from the state. But the science of reading is one of the most exciting things we've done. We're showing that it works. The other thing that I think all three of us would say, I've taken the data in Iredell County, but this is nationwide. If you look at students that are economically disadvantaged and you look at students that aren't, if you look at the second week of kindergarten, we typically give a test to all students. There's a 2 to 2.5 year difference between incoming kindergartens from affluent families to economically disadvantaged. So those students are behind that far. And I think all of us would say if we could have every kid that needs pre-K enter pre-K, that would definitely improve the number of students leaving third grade reading on grade level.
Dr. Kopicki, the schools in North Carolina, the public schools, have been, at least according to the judge in the Leandro case, have been chronically underfunded. I don't want to get into the particulars of the Leandro case because it goes back a decade or so, but they essentially told the legislature, you're not living up to your constitutional responsibilities, fund these schools, and they have yet to do so at the level that the judge said they should be funded. And a final decision on all this is still in the wings after 10 years or so. But the question is money the answer to the problems facing public schools in North Carolina? Is that the answer?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I'm always cautious when I answer this because I believe obviously the funding of public education is crucially important to making sure that we get high quality teachers in our building, keep our programs high quality, making sure that we're doing the right research and putting the right method, instructional methods in place in front of our kids. You also want to make sure that you have the right programs, whether it be extracurricular in the classroom, to make sure you can support those extra things that go on in the school system. But I don't believe it's all funding. Money is not the answer to everything. I think it starts with people, getting the right people in the classroom. So it starts from the very beginning process when you're interviewing your teachers. In Cabarrus County, we have over 220 nationally certified board teachers, which is quite a great credential to have. And we promote that actively here to get our teachers to continue to improve their instructional methods. So I think it's the investment in people, and it's in constantly observing, evaluating where you are in terms of people you have around you, making sure that you're hiring the right people from the get-go. Making sure you're evaluating your data, looking at how you are performing on the assessments, looking from that point, then looking at what does that information tell you in terms of are your programs working, is your instruction working? It's about putting your funding in the right places to make sure you're getting the most bang for your buck. Money's not always it's not the only answer. It's a big part of the equation because we want to be able to have the affordability to provide a great education, but there are other variables. I don't know if I've done a great job explaining that, but there are other variables that go into making sure that you have a high-performing school system.
Teacher pay is certainly part of the formula, because if you want good teachers, you have to be competitive with other industries, because teachers now have options that perhaps they didn't have 50 years ago. And in North Carolina, we rank 43rd in average teacher pay out of 50 states, 39th in beginning teacher pay. Teachers at CMS get a supplement from Mecklenburg County. How does teacher compensation in your districts compare with that at CMS and with each other? And what kind of supplement do you receive from your respective counties? You're right next door in Union County, Dr. Houlihan. I'll start with you.
Yes, we try to stay as competitive as we can with districts like CMS. More recently, what we've been really paying attention to beyond CMS is the state of South Carolina. That state has put in a bipartisan effort to raise beginning teacher pay to $50,000 plus by, I believe, I want to say the year 2027. That progress is continuing, and we've seen a lot more of our employees in the recent past who want to get a salary increase actually leave the state. That is besides CMS, that's a big concern that we have as well. In terms of supplement increases, we every year we ask for a supplement increase for our classroom teachers in particular. What makes it hard in a year like this year is you don't have a state budget. That's very concerning to all of us. And the impact of that is, number one, all funds have not been released to school districts from the state. And number two, I can't issue supplement increases to teachers until I know what the state budget is going to be, because I have to be able to measure what impact the state will have so I can make sure I have the funding to pay all of our local salaried individuals. So it's a very complex situation. We try to stay competitive as we can, and we really rely on the culture of our district to help, you know, recruit and retain individuals. We also focus on differentiated compensation. So in a lot of our Title I and hard to staff schools, we do pay more. We have a strategic staffing initiative right now in one middle school, Monroe Middle, that if you come as an eighth grade core teacher, you can make upwards of $30,000 extra dollars in the next 2 years. And so we try to do some innovative stuff like that. But on the whole, in my opinion, teacher pay across the state has got to get better. It's got to increase, and we've got to get greater support. at the state and local levels to make that happen.
Dr. Kopicki.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead,
Mike.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I agree. I think it's a huge legislative issue, and you tapped on it a little bit earlier when we started talking about the opportunity scholarships. We may not be anti-private, anti-charter, and we're all willing to accept the competition and have at it. But when you're putting $4 to $5 billion over a 10-year period in opportunity tax scholarships, that takes money out of public education and teacher salaries. The North Carolina Association of Education, you're correct, they rank us 43rd, which I believe we dropped five spots from the previous year from 38 to 43rd. And depending on what data set you look at, we're somewhere between 42 and 48 in the country. The state average is about 58,000, national average is 72,000. So I ask you, if you're coming out of college, where are you going to go? You're going to look where the money's the most and where your career choice is. I think the other problem is the pay stays low. Students that are going into college right now, are they going to get into, what career choice are they making? We're not really putting the impetus behind putting kids in the career choice to say pick public education as a career. When you look at what you could be making as an engineer or as a nurse or whatever it may be, another profession, it's financially the reward's not there. So you're seeing less and less kids get into the profession, and we're seeing that, all three of us are seeing that, in terms of the recruitment and who's coming through our doors. We're trying to hire quality folks, and it's less and less folks that we're being able to recruit, because we're all in teacher shortage situations, especially in our EC departments or math or science departments. It's crucial to our success. So we are kidding each other. We think that the Opportunity Tax Scholarship Program has not hurt public education from a salary perspective. Yes, they've given us raises, but when you're talking 2 and 3%, you can say, well, I've given you a raise. You have. But are you really being competitive? And that's really what it's all about. And when you have a state like North Carolina, which is one of the fastest growing states and has a business incubator where people are coming here, Lilly just put a billion-dollar plan here in Concord that we've benefited greatly from and are excited about it. But these are things that, you know, we need to start taking a hard look at in terms of, are we investing in our kids' futures? They'll tell you they are, but the public education is still where the majority of kids are coming through the system to be educated.
So I have about 30 seconds left, Dr. Kopicki, but Cabarrus County Schools are the eighth largest system in the state, and you provide, I believe I'm accurate in saying, you provide a 12% supplement to the state base scale for teachers. Where does that put average teacher pay in your system?
We hover probably around 56, 57,000 if I take the average with the supplement. But again, when you look at the national average, 72,000, and I don't need to talk about the economy and what's going on in the country, it's hard to live on that by yourself.
Yeah. Dr. John Kopicki, superintendent of Cabarrus County Schools, here with Dr. Jeff James with Iredell Statesville Schools and Dr. Andrew Houlihan with Union County Schools. We're coming right back to talk about public education and the state of it in a moment. Stay with us. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're back with the superintendents of three area school districts, Union County, Cabarrus County, and Iredell Statesville Schools. Dr. Jeff James is superintendent of Iredell Statesville Schools. And in May, Dr. James, it was reported that the Iredell Statesville system faced a $3 million shortfall and warned that a dozen teaching positions could get cut next year. As a result, you also said that you expected more cuts to happen each year. Where does that stand today? You said that was back in May. Where does that stand today?
Well, we've been fortunate enough not to actually RIF, which we consider a reduction in force. It's actually mandatorily remove someone from a position. So through attrition, we always try to move individuals and place them in different locations. But in my team, 6 years, we have reduced central office by 18 positions. That's about $2.3 million reoccurring. And it gets a little difficult some days because we all wear multiple hats, but that's sort of the severity of budget cuts. There comes a point where we have to have money to operate. And I would put public schools up with all the accountability we have, all the audits we have. I would challenge anyone to find that we misappropriate money. When 92% of your money is going to salary and benefits, it's sort of hard to squander money anywhere. So we are probably one of the most efficient operating organizations they are. And one of the things Dr. Kopicki was talking about, we have all but destroyed the teacher pipeline in North Carolina. We have seen education schools go under, stop having education programs. When we decided we weren't going to pay for the master's degree, that impacted a lot of our teachers wanting to be administrators. So the old adage again, throwing the baby out with the bathwater, when you stop one thing and think it only impacts one small entity in public education, you're completely wrong. So we have done multiple things across our state that has significantly impacted the future of education. Our kids, 10 years ago, and I think my colleagues would say this, you could walk into a class and say, hey guys, how many of you are thinking about going into a teaching career? 60% of the room would raise their hands. I go into a stadium of 2,000 or 3,000 people and ask the question now, I might get one or two hands. So $41,000 starting pay is the problem, is one of the problems. So think about it, in Iredell County, Best NC says the average household income here just come out was $82,000. So very few people are going to come out at $41,000. If they try to start a family, they have now went into the role of poverty. So it's sort of depressing that the most important people in our society we're paying the least. And the biggest impact on any child is the quality of teachers. So Mike, you mentioned other entities, private schools, one close to us in another county, is $25,000. So, you know, paying $25,000 to get your kid in pretty well guarantees the teacher's making is going to start at $60,000, $70,000, $80,000. So we should be paying our...
You and others, we on this program, and we've talked to a lot of school superintendents and teachers on this program through the years, have all brought this up countless times. And we bring it up every budget session, every time budgets roll around, that the teachers aren't paid enough. And if you want to keep and attract good teachers, you got to pay them, you got to respect them, etc. Why is that message not getting through? Or is it getting through and they just don't care?
I think the average person, and we said it earlier on, we don't do a really good job of advertising. But Mike,
well,
again,
you shouldn't have to advertise to a state legislature. These people are educated, allegedly. They're supposed to know this. They're supposed to have their fingers on the pulse of the things that they operate in the state, and that's the public school system is one, certainly one of them. Why don't they understand the competitive nature of being a school teacher in this and every other state in the country and provide the funds that are necessary to keep and attract the best teachers? It would seem to me that if you want to have business relocate here and more people coming here, increasing your tax base, you would want to be able to brag about the level of public education.
Absolutely. You're talking common sense now, but I'm not so sure everyone has common sense. So, and I'll bet you if we took a poll, a lot of those people sitting in Raleigh got a private education. So I'm pretty sure a lot of them didn't go through public school, but what I think what hurts us the most, I wouldn't be sitting here if it wasn't for public school, and thank God for it and the teachers I had. But I preach that all the time because again, this is my second career and I have multiple degrees and it makes common sense to you and I, but I'm not sure common sense is common when it comes to public school. It's almost okay. Like there's a plan to disenfranchise public school.
Is there one? Right. Is there one?
It
Gentlemen,
appears.
I'm just curious about, I'd like to hear from the other two about this. Is there a plan to dismantle public education or weaken it to the point where it's no longer viable? Dr. Houlihan.
To be honest with you, I'm not sure about a plan. I've not seen a full plan. There are certainly some signs that concern all of us. I do want to comment, Mike, on going back on the original or the other question around teacher recruitment and what Dr. Kopicki said about and Dr. James about, you know, our youth, right? So we've really, I think more and more of us have really started to focus hard on what is it that for kids in high school, even middle and high school, what is it that we can do, that we can control within our own school systems to encourage more of our youth to become teachers. We started doing that research before the pandemic, and we quickly learned that one of the things that is a big differential is, can I get out of college debt free? And, you know, one example of that is the North Carolina Teaching Fellows Program, which has, when I was a product of North Carolina Teaching Fellows, it ended. The General Assembly brought it back in a limited fashion. We in Union County have kind of taken that model and created our own pipeline program that we call Teach UCPS that has had a huge impact on the number of kids that will now say to me, I want to become a teacher because the program offers scholarships to get them out of college debt-free. And, you know, so I think for all of us, understanding the social political environment that we're in, we've got to look within and not necessarily always rely on outside entities like colleges of education alone.
I want to switch gears here before we run out of time, because all three of your systems have a significant number of Hispanic students, and there's a lot of concern in that community about what's going on with deportations. The final Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board meeting prior to the start of school this year was marked by concerns among members of that community about immigration enforcement operations at the schools. They were frustrated that CMS isn't doing more to prepare for the possibility that ICE agents could enter school grounds. In fact, the grounds of schools and the lobbies of schools are not off limits to ICE. According to one person at that meeting, quote, kids are scared of going into school again. Parents are scared of taking their kids to school. And that fear is not paranoia, but based on the reality that families are being harassed all across the country. I know that similar concerns were expressed in February in Union County. Dr. Kopecky, what's the situation in Cabarrus?
Yeah, I would definitely say that it's a concern that we keep a close eye on. I don't want to use the word fortunate, but we have not really dealt with any ICE situations to this point. We are becoming much more diverse. Our population right now is about 23% African-American, about 20% Hispanic, 14% Asian, about 6% multiracial, and about 38% Caucasian or white. So we are very diverse. We spent a lot of time last year when this was a hot issue with our administrators and explaining them what the appropriate subpoenas were that we had need to be aware of, and making sure that, you know, we were well versed in how to handle the authorities if they did show up at our schools. And the truth of the matter is what we have said to all of our administrators and our teachers and everyone, we will follow the law, cooperate with the law. We may not like it, but we're going to follow the law and be good citizens to uphold the law of the land. But we've been fortunate to this point where we have not had any ICE agents in our district.
Both of the other superintendents nodded when you said we will follow the law, so I'm assuming I don't have to ask that question of them. I'll just bring that out to the fore here. There have been recent federal cuts to SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. They're set to begin on October the 1st. One of the things that SNAP does is to enable children from eligible families to get a free school breakfast and a free school lunch during the school year and to get food benefits during the summer when school is not in session. How do you see these new restrictions impacting your students? Because if you don't eat, you can't learn. Let's begin in Iredell, Statesville. Dr. James?
Well, Mike, I just had this conversation before we went on air with the county commissioner. And I think my colleagues would say one of the most efficient ways to feed the kids in our nation is the national child nutrition program. You cannot beat the price that we provide a meal to our students for. But once again, with all the other cuts, we're finding that we're going backwards on things that we had made a lot of forward gain on. So 38 schools here, we had 23 of them where everyone received free breakfast, free lunch. So, and we saw the participation rates go up to over 100,000 meals a week. When we were charging students, it was 50 or less. So that tells you that probably 50% of our kids cannot afford to buy the meal, which is typically around $3 for lunch and about $2 for breakfast. And my comment to several politicians recently has been, you know, the most efficient way to feed our children is through our public schools. And you're once again throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Let us do what we can do best and most efficient. So that's been a huge topic, but it's definitely going to impact the number of kids we have that are in classrooms hungry.
I would think the same is the same situation in Cabarrus and probably every school system in the country for lower income children. How concerning is it to you in Cabarrus County, Dr. Kopicki, that some kids, if these cuts go into effect on October the 1st, will come to school hungry and stay hungry? How will they learn?
Well, I mean, we always talk about and refer to educating the whole child and providing those resources to our children that they need. And feeding our children is absolutely one of the highest priorities that we have at our doorstep to make sure that they're well fed and well nourished. So any possible impact that would impact our, especially our direct certification, is going to concern us. So we've noticed already this year, we're down about 4% in our free reduced population. Now it's very early in the school year, so we're still processing a lot of our paperwork and promoting that for our families to apply for free reduced lunches. But any drop in that significantly is a worry, because you want to make sure the kids are being fed and that they're being taken care of and they're maintaining good health.
This year, the legislature passed and the governor signed into law several new initiatives that affect schools, among them rules governing cell phone use during instruction time. School boards need to have a policy in place now by January 1st of next year. Some school boards already have policies in place. Many of them will have to alter those policies to be in line with a stricter version of those policies that the state will now require. Dr. Houlihan, what does this new law require and how will it impact Union County schools and students?
So for us in Union County, everything that was basically stipulated in the current law was already in place in our school system through our code of conduct. It was not a board policy per se, but it is now. At our last board meeting, our board adopted a cell phone policy that becomes a board policy now that echoes the law. But for us, in an implementation standpoint, especially for our middle and high schools, there will be no change. Kids in high school will still be allowed to use their phones during transitions, at lunchtime, et cetera. From my perspective, I was personally against this law. I believe it's far-reaching oversight. When 75% of districts already were dealing with this issue, I believe that this should have been handled at the local level as opposed to a statewide law. But for us, we had already taken care of this issue. And for our teachers in particular, it was a non-issue. As a parent, I believe that it's important for our kids to have access to their phones from a safety standpoint. But again, for us, this really will be a non-issue for us moving into the school year when it comes to implementation.
There are now social media literacy requirements as well. House Bill 659 requires schools to implement certain internet safety and security measures if they haven't done so already, beginning in 2026. What will this require your district to accomplish in Cabarrus County, Dr. Kopicki?
Yeah, we already have a very good platform in place for that. We're a little bit ahead of this. We have a digital citizenship platform that we use. It's an online platform. It provides 8 different modules that we use. We use that through Neptune Navigate, and all of our students are well versed on a lot of the different things that incorporate social media into the classroom. And this year, we focus a little bit more on the artificial intelligence to make sure that we are appropriately using that in the classroom and finding responsible ways to bring that into the school system. So I feel as though that we've been very well prepared for that. Our technology staff, with the leadership of Carl Sain, have done a really nice job at educating our teachers and providing that appropriate professional development.
And as long as we're talking about that, tech companies, including Snapchat, Facebook, reported more than 9,600 cases of adults grooming children in the UK this year. In that same time frame, the U.S.-based National Center for Missing and Exploited Children indicated that Snapchat reported about 20,000 instances of concerning material, including sextortion and child sexual abuse images in the first half of the year. Do we know what kind of controls do you have? What kind of education surrounding media literacy? And I have 30 seconds here. Do you have in place to help students understand the dangers here? Who would like to answer that? Dr. Houlihan, I'll let you do it. 30 seconds.
Yeah, so we that a lot of that goes through our number one, the core classroom teacher in terms of the appropriate use of social media. But we also have a student support division that does a lot of work with parent education and making sure that they're equipped to understand what they can do at home to help their children navigate that work as well.
Dr. Andrew Houlihan is superintendent of Union County Schools. Dr. John Kopicki, superintendent of Cabarrus County Schools. Dr. Jeff James, superintendent of Iredell Statesville Schools. Thank you all three for the hour. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.